The season for the Bucks to really define their greatness is off to a rocky start. Actually, it looks a lot like a shambles right now, after suffering a thrashing at the hands of the Aussies at home. Is this an exaggeration? Was it just a bad day? Is Tony Ball slowly blunting the Bucks? Is this Bucks squad starting to suddenly look a little bit old? Why can't they hit a fucking lineout? So many questions. So many, many questions. But is there anyone that can really answer them for us? Thankfully, there is someone. It's none other than seasoned rugby man and all-round Lekker Oak from the Lekker Rugby Pod, Harry Jones. Give him your time and gain a world of insights right here. It's episode 62 of the On The Bounce Show. It's the Big Bock Picture from here with Harry Jones. Let's get into it. Hello, welcome to it, episode 62 of the podcast. And we are here, time of recording, I'll state this for context, 18th of August. South Africans, we are absolutely...
Shattered.
There was another word, probably shouldn't go so hard right off the bat. Let's just say we're not feeling our best right now. Yeah. As South Africans, we've become so used to winning, especially when our icons like the Springboks and Dricus du Plessis do us proud. They're our world champs. They're both browbeaten. I really got to try praising this because otherwise my emotions are going to come out and then I go into a tirade. This is a redemption show. We're going to get things together here. We're going to sort of steady the ship and work out, should we be in a state of panic or should we just be in a state of bring on the weekend? In order to do so, on my left, as always, is Sandile Shangasi. Do not ask him about Man United.
Don't ask me about anything about sports, but like we said, another week. So we get to redeem ourselves. So I'm out here. I'm ready to deal with the problems.
Positive footing. Love it. And then, of course, as the AI guy said in the intro, we've got Harry Jones here.
Yes, sir.
Harry, I have followed you online. I've engaged with you slightly here and there. And now to see you in the flesh with your generous eyebrows, what a treat.
Luxurious eyebrows.
Yes, I'll go with the luxurious. Yes.
No, guys, actually, you know, it's good to sit around the fire after the war and discuss, you know, our wounds. And it was ever thus. Why do we even have sports unless we're willing to lose?
Yeah. So true.
I mean, there's no one alive that is a real partisan fan that hasn't got to go through the wars. And we've had a really nice run. We won well.
Yep.
Some people said we won a little bit generously, luxuriantly, like our eyebrows were a bit thick when we were winning. So now we've got to take it on and analyze it. And also think it could go one of two ways. This was a calamity, of course, because we bit off more than we could chew. With the 11,000-1 pass to run ratio, kick ratio. But at the end of the season, or maybe even the next season, this is one of those ones you look back and say, and that was the moment that we found our humility again. Yes. You know, we stopped being so vinchat. We shed some of that skin that we were carrying around. It also gave us a valuable look, I think, into some of the older guys and where they are. But also that seething, quiet desire for revenge that motivates every professional sports team that ever existed. You know, Liverpool, when they were starting soccer and they want to beat the guys, it was an organized melee. It was, crime legalized. And rugby is crime pardoned. So this is the greatest thing to motivate the back-to-back-to-back, which is just take it on, swallow it, hear it, remember it.
Yes.
Don't say so much right now and then... dish it back in Australia in 27.
All right, guys. So as his first foray on the Bounce Show, if he's giving us that, can you imagine what he's going to give us for the rest of this episode? We're going to take a little break to show you what Shaz and I got up to this last weekend because Box Saturdays at Benchwarmers, they're a thing, okay? Win, lose, or draw is a victory. No, I'm not going to quote PJ Powers here. But we had a good time, and we're going to give you a little bit of insight as to what it is up here in Joburg.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the House of Sports, the home of champions. We're at Benchwarmers Sports Bar. We're here to watch the Springboks versus the Wallabies. And they're going to take it down. And it's here, me and Ben are here. Let's go.
Rassi, fucking genius, man. Very innovative. We try new things. We the benchmark, you know. And I just sort of don't understand how we still going into the rugby championship as the underdogs, the favourites on New Zealand?
I think today the Springboks are going to win, as always.
Why do you love the Springboks?
Because you love them.
Definitely it'll be a tight game. I think the Wallabies will push us. About 5 points in it. Yeah, it's we're looking, starting lineup, not sure about it, but the Wallabies had a great series against the Lions. It's going to be hella tight. I think they could push us, and I wouldn't be surprised if the Wallabies pull this off. But obviously, go poker.
Our forwards are going to pummel them, first of all. And this is the first time the Springboks, technically, like, Australia's always had the most tens. This time they only had like one. We have like three tens like, in their prime. So I would give a score prediction of maybe two tries. Two tries from Australia and a good six from us. 42 to 12, that's my prediction.
Downs. My bro's been up. They the guys, you know, we the guys. But now we down. Life goes in waves, yin and yang, to go up and down. So right now we're coming back. The next one is up. Think about that.
All right, the result didn't go our way, but it's still a great day at Benchwarmers. Shazlin are going to be here the whole season. So when it comes Saturday, it becomes Box Saturday. Come join us.
Go!
That was dope.
All right, it was a solid Saturday, not for the Bok result, but a great day out of Benchwarmers with us. You know, because we want to try to get out of the studio a bit more this year. Yeah. And of course, when the Saturdays are that good, and the vibe of the people, hey? Yeah. Like, that's what I love about your bar so much, is that there's knowledgeable people, and there's people who are just there for the vibes.
Yeah, there are people there who undergo sports. But shout out to my guys, Tuso Mamba, Mateki, Two Shoes, giving us words of wisdom at the end. They're saying, you know, life happens, we'll be back. So I really appreciate that. Shout out to everyone who pulled up.
Okay, so Harry, you were at the game.
Yeah.
Now, just a bit of context of why this game is so upsetting if you're not a huge Bok fan like we are. The Boks are now down to the third in the world. Okay? Let's not get into the nuances of the world rankings right now. We were first, now we're third. Don't lose your home games is the moral of the story here. You released a podcast the day after the match. So it was episode 101, the Lekker Rugby Pod. You and Imvia Velman. Cutting, yet so informative. Absolutely loved it. If you haven't listened to that podcast, you got to get it. I think even going into this match this weekend, so many of these wounds are so raw that you just touch over them brilliantly. There was also two, just before we get into Harry's thoughts around the game, because he was there, there was two tweets that sort of come up and I think are great precursors to what we're about to talk about. Ryan Freda, so we start with Zelim Nell. He said, outstanding grit from Australia to survive the early flurry, regroup and respond to punish a Bok team caught trying to prove a buffalo can also swing from the branches. Now, similarly, Ryan Freda, he said, Rossi allowing Tony Brown to convince him that his oxen should be trained to strut like show ponies
is a modern-day rugby tragedy. I thought Rusty was smarter. So, Harry, the reason I want to start with those two tweets is that we picked a team to basically be show ponies, put up a huge score, run it ragged. But Test match rugby isn't as simple as that, is it? And it came back to bite us.
No, for sure. And it's almost like you planned an event, a big party, you know, all the family, and then you had sort of three positions for that huge event of 1,000 people. There was going to be a logistics person, there was going to be a master of ceremonies, and there was going to be a DJ. But instead, you hired three DJs. And you said, let's just make sure the food somehow arrives with people, all three of you trying to vibe each other to death from behind your DJ.
Such a great
stands.
Analogy.
And so there's a place for that. I mean, basically, Andre Pollard and Willy LaRue is the odd couple. So it's actually fun to have a Pollard and a Willemse together. It's fun to have someone like Williams, you know, serving it up for, you know, a more conservative. I think the problem was there was nowhere to go once the thing got out of hand.
Yeah.
So what do you, so you look to the bench and you say, where do I have? Do I have someone who's an 80, 90 cap game manager, the boring accountant, the guy who can shout at everyone? I just imagined in my mind someone like Andre taking everyone aside and saying, we're actually still ahead. It's 22-10, 22-12.
Let's get it together.
We may not score that much in the next 5 minutes, but they're not going to score either. Maybe it's 3-3 in the next 20 minutes and then build. The problem was we played as if we were behind when we were ahead and then as if we were ahead when we were behind, doing a lifting pod. On the other hand, I do think the biggest problem of going back-to-back-to-back is complacency and being caught.
Yes.
So you do have to bring a Tony in, but you also have to save Tony from his worst ideas. You know, it's like the best partnership is I save you from your worst instincts. So Nina Aber and Erasmus was always this weird, odd couple as well, where, you know, I have crazy ideas and you say, no, not that one, but this one maybe. So what you're looking at, I think, is maybe someone said to Mani in the beginning, be free, be your freest self. And then if you say that 12 times to a guy and then in the middle of the thing when it's going kind of wrong, you say, no, now just keep doing the kick chase. Skopanjach.
Yep. Tighten it up.
Yeah, and have buffaloes running downhill. It's difficult to message that in the cauldron, the cacophony of a test match with everyone banging. Or the crowd's going to celebrate your bridge passes. They love it when you do, you know, the steps.
Yeah.
And they boo you kind of when you do the faff box kick. But that's what you needed all night long.
Mm. Exactly.
Because Tom Wright and those Max Jorgensen hadn't demonstrated they could go up in the air against Fassi, against Eben, against the Chasers, and actually haul it in.
So, look, you touched on it in the beginning, is that sometimes a loss can be like a seminal moment in things coming together. You know, as we spoke about on Saturday, is that this team needs to really kind of refine what the identity might be. So, I'm just going to quote you throughout this whole thing, but you've got to freshen things up, okay? Go back to back and suddenly you can try to win the three-peat. You can't do it in the same sort of thing. I know we know what Bok rugby is. We know the DNA. We know what works. We know it's strong. And it might be a bit boring, but there had to be a bit of a freshening. So do you think that Saturday was a result of us looking too far ahead in the season and thinking Oryx need to be primed for, say, the New Zealand tour, and right now we'll beat the Aussies with X, X being whoever we put on the field, and they'll express themselves?
Ben, before Harry jumps in, I remember we had this long conversation. I said, Australia coming off the Lions tour and being heavily underestimated is going to become a big issue for us. And I think we actually, you know, we're victims of our own success. We think we can just walk onto a rugby pitch and win a game.
No, I think Australia is our forgotten rivalry. It's our overlooked rivalry. It's really one of the closest ones. It's about a 10-match edge for us, and it's really a home and away. So we overlook them. Australia often shows us the exact point that we lack. We sometimes get caught by them because they don't sort of follow the cardinal rules of rugby. They're a bit of an outlier in how they play defensively. And so I think, yeah, we overlooked them. We timed our heavy training session, which gave us dead legs for 3 weeks, to coincide with the taper and then coincide with Eden Park. That was it. You know, it's the trifecta: Eden Park, Dublin, and Paris. And so we overlooked them. I think I was guilty of disrespect. I think we were all guilty of looking beyond it and sort of having, you know, parlor games of how many will it be, 40, 50, 30.
Yeah.
Not complete disrespect, but sort of walking into Ellis Park, I didn't feel nerves. No one was nervous.
Yeah.
There was just that party vibe.
Well, that's another reason why I wanted to show you the benchwarmers montage, because nobody was nervous there.
Nobody
we
was
were all there for a fat jaw on a Saturday with no apprehension. One guy, one knowledgeable guy, was like, "Look, guys,
something may happen.
Aussie's going to push us."
Yeah. I think for me, it's where to from here. That's where I have a kind of a big issue, because we know our team is getting older, but I think games like this really expose it. Where it's like, do we really need the fresh guys in now? Or do we go with tried and tested, you know? And that's where I think the tinkering of like the backline. And, you know, I've been hypercritical about Mani Lubok since the beginning of time. And games like this don't do him any favors, when you can see he's been instructed to do one thing. And then when things turn around, he's been instructed to do the other, which you can never build, you know, you can never protect him. And he right now, with what's been happening around him, I really expected Rusty to give him more protection and actually a stricter instruction. Well, because it was too free.
Sorry, straight to that. With all these games, you pack it out. It's never about one player. It's never about one thing. Yeah. But how big of a deal is Damien de Allende in this team? Because if Marnie was skip-passing him all the time, I'm pretty sure he would say, Marnie,
maybe not.
Let's crash up a little bit here. Whereas maybe someone like Andre Esthezen wouldn't say that. Because like every time Esthezen got the ball, he looked pretty good going up the middle and doing what Bok Rugby is.
Yeah.
But Marnie would just...
Yeah, we were very quiet. We weren't talking, and being close down to the pitch, you could kind of sense that there wasn't enough communication, changes, you know. Damien's really good. Gaza's really good at the defensive side too. So he would have crowded James O'Connor.
Yeah.
Would have worked his way through those forward pods to get where James O'Connor was not facing any inside heat, which allowed him to get outside and throw those Sydney Harbour bridge passes that worked in the end, but they were millimeters away from being disastrous. So if you caught him, and Andre was never close to touching him, that's one thing. Second thing, on the age and the fresh, it's like our bodies. We want some parts of our bodies to be young forever and others were okay, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's different parts of the rugby field that I think we need that. 9, 10, 15, we were light. We were 20-20 and then we were 20 caps each, yeah, up against the only part of the Wallaby squad that was super experienced.
Yeah.
You know, with Wright being 40, Nick Wright maybe 80 caps. Nick White, about 80 caps, and then James O'Connor, 65 caps, but really 100.
Yeah.
Because he's played all over the world.
He was good in his early 20s.
And so that's the problem there is, you know, we were super experienced in some positions, like the scrum, but didn't really help us that much because, you know, we were to win a scrum and make something out of it, you have to win the ensuing lineouts. We weren't winning the lineouts.
Yeah.
So in a perfect storm, what the Wallabies were able to do was absorb, soak, like 2011, the Caketon quarterfinal, like so many Australian victories where they just absorb and don't die, don't quit, hang in there. So to me, it was a triumph of spirit. They had more chias. They had more ability to handle a punch. We got full of ourselves at 22-0, and we decided we won't do the thing that got us here.
Yeah.
We won't stay with the girl we brung to the dance. We're going to go somewhere else.
We're going to look for somebody else.
Yeah.
So just to kind of like taper off what the game was, you were at the press conference. What was the major take out there? Because there would be a lot of people. We all know Box Saturdays, emotions run high. And media, I'm not saying it's their job or their goal, but they haven't had a pitchfork moment in quite some time in this country. Do you feel like it actually came out on Saturday?
Well, Rossi came in ready to take mea culpa. He does what he's always done from the start. Not in an ugly way, but just saying, blame me. Take the, you know, I take the blame. But he also tried to absolve various parties. One, he tried to absolve Tony Brown,
yeah,
by saying in the Afrikaans portion that it wasn't his skill, it wasn't his fault. He was the one shouting, overplaying. I don't know if that's true or not, but Tony's also the architect of Peter Steph Tatoi being in one tram, Sia Kolisi being on the other. So when you have a Marku, he goes off and it's Quagga. Quagga's manning the middle as your stopper. In the world of rugby, that doesn't stop Harry Wilson, who's not the biggest eight, but he's still a proper eight. So there's systems that Tony's got in hand here beyond whether you did something on that game that lend us, you know, like, do we have to just keep saying Evan Roos is a duus? Or can we say, but he's still a proper eight who goes hard and can carry 25 times?
Can he be a duus sometimes? He can be a duus eight.
Yeah, maybe. And yeah, exactly. And I think, so Rossi was sort of taking on the system part of it and say, no, it's not that.
Yeah.
He was also saying, but I recognize that 9 kicks from hand in second half is not enough.
Yeah.
So he was actually saying, so then the question becomes, and the press probably didn't dig hard enough on this enough, is who told who
what?
to kick more and they didn't listen, or when? And because at 22-19, the game's still on. But it almost felt like in the stadium, I don't know about you guys.
Inevitability.
Okay, now we're done. Like, why? 22-19, I'd be the 22. Yeah. I don't want to be the 19.
Yeah, sure. Makes a lot of sense. Obviously, another factor this year is what the Bucks will do on tour. Okay, now this is a really, really important part of this year because it's away to the All Blacks. So last week, I went to the Peregrine Capital event. They are well known for turning $1 million into $100 million in the investment space. And what they've done is they've got all the Box Centurions together as part of this big campaign. So I went to the event to launch this. And in doing so, I got to get some thoughts from Brian Abana, Jean de Villiers, and Victor Matfield on the dynamics of touring and why it's going to be so important for this Box team this year.
JDB, touring. We had some good ones.
I always enjoyed a tour. And I think what you miss the most when you retire from rugby is actually the fact that you spend time with each other, yeah. And especially on tours.
The bonding that happens on tour, it just doesn't happen at home. It doesn't happen when you're in your home because there's responsibilities, family.
And we say it a lot as well. A tour is sometimes a good thing for a team. You know, even though it's not nice to be away from home, but you know, you go away, you're there as a unit together. Every single minute of the day, you get to know each other on a different level, and I think that's the beauty of a team sport. And
one of the toughest places to not only tour but to win rugby games is in New Zealand. For a tour like this, what do we think is going to make a historic difference?
Yeah, well, I think these guys are still already such a proper unit. Yeah. You know, they know each other so well. They know how to be on the field and off the field. I think we'll win one. Of the two, which one I don't know. I'd prefer to be in Auckland just because of the history there. But do you remember 2013 when we played in Auckland? The Bismarck red card.
Oh, the red card, Dan Carter.
I remember before that game, I remember the team talk in the hotel. I just felt that was like we were in such a good space, and then that happened. And that's some of the regrets you have as a player as well. But touring always remains special.
100%.
Talking tonight about Centurions playing 100 test matches, a lot of people asking, do you play for the Caps? But that's not what it's about. It's about the people in the team, people you want to spend time with, people you want to be with, people you just love doing things together. And a lot of the guys spoke about hardships and going through difficult times, and those bonds get together when you're on tour. Because you're away from home a lot of times, 4 to 6 weeks, you spend a lot of time together. And if you're not big mates, you can't enjoy those tours. So I always enjoyed all the tours. Wherever you go, you need to be ambassador for South Africa, be proud South Africans, and as a senior player, you need to show that. So I think there's a lot of responsibilities on the seniors, and I think you want to teach the youngsters, yes, we need to have fun, we need to enjoy each other's company, but we need to be the ambassadors for our country.
Is there something particularly difficult about New Zealand and touring New Zealand that you could really pinpoint?
Now, firstly, New Zealand's a lovely country to tour. It's one of my favourite countries to go because the people love rugby. Wherever you go, they carry you on their hands. But you're always in the spotlight as well. And then, of course, when you play the All Blacks there, it's the hardest test you can get. You don't win there often. We've spoken tonight a lot about Australia not winning in South Africa. We don't win there quite often. So going over there, you need a certain discipline, you need commitment, and you need guys to drive each other to get that victory. So very tough to go there, but one of the best places to tour as well.
Yeah, such a cool evening there with Peregrine Capital. I always love talk, like that generation for me have the best stories because they've had enough time away from the game now. their careers didn't have social media. It's like our interview with John last week. You know, John Smith has some really, really great stories. And it's really cool when like brands get together and really celebrate that kind of stuff. So Harry, the main part of what I want to discuss with you here is that people are going to look for what's going to be a fix for the box situation right now, even if there is one. We touched on some really great points as to where they fell flat in this particular game at the start of the Rugby Championships. But certain things create sort of catalysts for the change. As we're watching this video now, you mentioned how the British and Irish Lions tour coming to Australia gave Australia to really come together, because they were in turmoil, let's be honest. There's a reason why we underestimated them. There's a reason why they weren't this vaunted sort of opposition. They were seventh in the world, in tatters really. Didn't have a good enough squad, and people were saying this Lions tour is going to be an absolute shock. It's going to be a disaster. But that tour really did something for them. It really gave them something to come around on.
Yeah, Australia lacks depth, and it lacks depth in coverage, in communities. They don't have this, you know, wealth of schools and the equivalent of a Craven Week or Grant Como. So they are always kind of on the back foot. But you only get to put 15 guys on the field at a time. And with the Lions series, with that us against the world, we were wronged, we were robbed, Carlo Tizzano moments, which I don't think was correct. It doesn't matter. It galvanized them. It gave them extreme knowledge of who their 15 players were, without a doubt.
Yeah,
it disabused them of some of the myths. So they kind of knew they needed a more experienced 9-10 combination once Jake Gordon went down. They didn't hesitate. Joe Schmidt kind of understood exactly where they could go. But the main body of the pack was cemented, but minus Rob Valentini, you know, who might come back in Cape Town. So once you have that kind of certainty, you have in a less deep team, you're just very much going into war together. Band of brothers, arm in arm. I feel you. I know where you're from. I know where you're going. So the box had pioneered this idea that there is no incumbency at 9, 10, and 15. We have a revolving door, horses for courses. We have an abundance of wealth. We can do a Faf. We can do a Grant. We can do a Kourbis. We can do Mornay. We can throw anyone at 9 who works with anyone. It could be any one of those guys could match up with extremely different fly-offs. Pollard, you know, Sasha and Mani. And then also we can have a Willemse, Willi, or Fassi. And it doesn't matter. No one owns the jersey. Only the midfield is owned. Only tight head lock. Only tight head. That's it. Maybe hooker. I think we were exposed to the idea that those fine margins we always talk about really are fine. We talk about them when we win because it's fun, 1 point. But when you lose, you realize, no, it really is fine the other way around too. And so I think I'm calling for a return to incumbency of some kind. Some solidity, some time in the saddle. I want to see how Mornay Van den Berg does with Andre Pollard. Andre Pollard is not old. He's still the right age profile to go to the next World Cup.
So, well, especially when you consider someone like a Johnny Sexton over the years.
Look at all Ireland the greats.
Ireland didn't have the depth either, really. Yeah. But look what they got out of incumbency.
And look how hard it was to actually, you know, replace him still. So Sexton, Dan Bigger, Owen Farrell, these types of guys, Finn Russell. No one's saying they're too old when they're doing their prime. So let's see who works best with Andre. Let's see who works best with Sasha. Let's identify people who have the full, you know, toolkit and then arm them. If Mani worked on his kicking and it worked, then maybe you could work on other things. But I do wonder about this idea that we're not going to identify who our top 9 is. It's all a vibe. It's all horses for courses. We can sit someone out over here and come in over there. I do think players are creatures of habit, most of them. They like routines. They like to know. And I think that's where we can have some easy fixes. Other easy fixes are when you're together for 9 weeks, your line out should be impeccable. It should be almost just a thing of beauty. And we're still now wondering about the line outs, which is, I would do this kind of game with coaches. And I say, if I give you five lost things, which one do you dread the most, you know, or which one do you want the most if you get them? So 5 scrum penalties, 5 line-out steals, 5 kicks regained, 5 line breaks. And it's interesting because their philosophy being asked an indirect question reveals more than if you just say, what's your philosophy?
Yeah.
And I think it's difficult to know right now what the box think that is. Whereas if I say to Dabo what it is, I know what he'll say. If I say to Akers coming into the Bulls, I know what he'll say. You know, he's going to want 5 line breaks. That's how he played with the Lions. Johan van Kraan's going to say, give me 5 scrum penalties. Dabo's going to say, give me five kicks regained. And they just have different philosophies. Right now for the Bucks, I'm not sure what it is. And I wonder about that, you know, because it's one thing to say we have to keep refreshing ourselves, but I still think if our best is better than someone else's best in any sport, then keep doing that until they prove they can stop it. But yes, have plan B, for sure. There are times when you need to outscore a team, and we didn't have that in our locker, and now I think we already do. But I'm not sure it's our leading card. I think our leading card is still we can out-muscle you, squeeze you, choke you, put you on the ground, and make you wish you would quit. And then if we, you know, if we have to catch you up in a hurry, maybe we can do that too. I don't think it should be run and gun, this swivel hip rugby, this sort of excitement machine. And then when you run out of gas, you have nothing. That's not a good look.
It really isn't. And I think the reason why I feel like we've got all the things to fix this relatively quickly is that I see this tour as being that position that we can get into. Now, I'm glad you brought up the whole incumbency thing, because I always look at that and go, okay, I get we need a bigger squad, because this is about getting fresh legs to the World Cup. This is about mitigating risk of, like, if this guy goes down, this guy stands up in the exact same frame. But it's almost like you can't win that war while still being really good in the current battles. And I think this is one of those things that you are always going to be straddled against. So I would like us to get back to that, but this is where it gets hard for me. And we already touched on this slightly, is the fresh legs, the older players, and the having incumbents around that. Do you think that Russie feels like, I want this guy to be an incumbent in 27. That's why I've got to manage him in the meantime. But in doing that, does that not just mess up what the current team is and where the team's going?
Yeah, storyboarding the next 2 or 3 years is not easy. I do think there was a bit of a check on Franco Mostert by putting him out there. Didn't look good as a fresh energy guy to close. So if the value of that was to know what we don't have and adjust accordingly, there is some value there. But I think you still always owe a responsibility to the country, to yourself, to life, to history, to win a rugby championship opener at Ellis Park against Australia, and then maybe use Cape Town as your permutations. Once you've banked that win. Losing the first one, no bonus point, and giving up a bonus point puts the whole championship now in sort of a desperation mode. When you look at the sort of final 20 minutes over 2 years, 3 years, the Bucs have always won that final 20 minutes.
Always. It's a hallmark of who they are.
And so the theory behind that was sort of twofold. One was, we're going to replace what we'd lost so we can let people burn themselves quick in the forward pack, expend it, go all, go hot, because you go out, someone comes in who's just like you. That's one theory. The other one is actually the opposite of that is, and we can bring on a point of difference by going 6-2, with either a hybrid or because we have multi-skilled people who can do that. You look at our bench at Ellis Park this weekend, it didn't do either of those things. Could you imagine what a guy like Arche Sneijman could have done if he were coming on at the critical moment? He can hold the ball up. He can offload. He can provide a pod center. Nothing that Franco Mostert could do. Franco almost came on like a smaller, less bearded Lewitt. And then Arche comes on like a completely different animal,
yep,
who's got elbow height over Will Skelton. He's got an ability to be that point of pivot, a multi-sided attack. He's done it for Leinster. He's turned matches. So you don't name him. Why? Quagga is definitely one of my favorite players. He's got a face and a meat grinder. He looks like he gives everything for anyone he loves. But if he's an energy guy now, if that's the energy function, and he's getting older, and he cannot stand up anyone in the tackle or stop them, then what's the point there? I always thought it was about having 4 to 5 locks on a 23 team. That's the point of the Bob squad. So if 20% of my team is the biggest guys and then 25% on the bench, and I'm basically saying a quarter of my team is big, and that always gives you something in a game. So we were small. We weren't quick off the bench because we had old guys in those positions. And Bongi is one massive accumulation of scar tissue. So he's not going to give you anything different. So then you look at sort of the backline point of difference, and it's Willemse in for Fassi, which is like for like.
Yep.
And you wonder, what's the whole point? Kobus Reinach is the oldest scrum off. So I don't think that was even well conceived. So fixes abound. You can definitely pick a 6-2 or even a 7-1 bench and go back to the idea of we will always be bigger than you, but we'll also give you things that you don't know about at 60 minutes. And that inevitability, that aura people talk about, which is actually a real thing. People don't like to say it, but it's true. Where you look at it and you go, ah, here they come again. They're going to beat us. There's none of that. Right now, that was punctured, and it's punctured for a while until we get it back.
Do you feel like this was kind of an inevitable result? Because if you look at how we played that first test against Italy, I'm sure we came back and hurt them in the second test. And then Georgia's Georgia. You're not too sure what you can draw from that. But do you feel like there was an air of inevitability of this happening at some stage this year?
There are patterns. There are trends. You can spot them. Rossi was asked that at the press conference, and he said, no, we're just not playing well. But we're just not playing well. But if we keep not playing well in the same way, it's a trend. And so we're not owning the final 30. We're not bringing energy on. We seem to be in love with our lead at some point. And instead of saying, let's consolidate it, let's slow things down, let's kind of eat the clock, we seem to be saying, so then let's do something also crazy. We don't roll any malls anymore. It's incredibly low. And we had 11-1 kick, post-kick ratio, which is twice as much as everyone else in the rugby championship. It's twice as much as the French. So we're playing like we are, I don't know, we're playing like we're some sort of Mediterranean team.
Bit of a barbars on the go kind of thing.
Yeah, and so I think that's always going to put us in danger. That's a trend. So there's one possible explanation, which is we're trying something. There was always a shelf life. There's a set agreement or an understanding that we're going to see if this works, and then we're going to go back to what worked before.
So I hope that's the case. And again, I mean, I referenced Adam Nell at the start of the show. So along with Harry, one of my favorite rugby podcasters, the Kiro and Zell show, and he said from earlier from Ireland last year, he's like, why are our buffaloes dancing? Why are we doing this? Why are we being forced into doing it? And I love the thing about give them more skills because it keeps them on their toes about what they need to do to become a bock. And secondly, it gives them more abilities to adapt within the game. So I'm not going to ask you what Russi might do. I want to actually know what you would do if you're in Russi's position. Do you have a cutoff time? Let's just use the Kwaku as an example. Your point was very good there. He's meant to be the action guy. He's the all action, speed, dynamism, last 20. Does he not have a cutoff time by you saying, look, it's 2026. We gave you a good run in 2025. If you're not doing the high tempo stuff now, no chance to do in 2027. This is kind of where we part ways. I know this sounds very final, a bit rough, but is this the kind of position where the guys need to actually exercise that this year?
Yeah, I think so. And there's probably the dreaded KPIs behind some of this. So Kwaga was always touted as the highest battle stat guy.
Yes.
And that was one of the – you almost associate battle stat with Kwaga. But you also have to have, you know, ratings within your actions. So, for example, Ulrich Lowe, I think, is 35% of his tackles are dominant. And dominant is defined by all the stat keepers as I stop you from the gain line, but I also push you back. That's a phenomenal stat. So even if maybe Ulrich Lowe had less battle stats than Kwaga, I would still take the 35% dominant tackles of a big, strong man who can stop someone in flight.
Especially as number eight.
Instead of I've completed 7 tackles in 10 minutes. Okay, that's good battle stats. But if you always fell backward and you were soak tackle with no possibility of turnover, I don't fold you in the wrong spot.
Offloads happened.
Exactly. So now my pilfers, you know, it's difficult to sort of turning moments. So I think with Kwaga, you'd have to say, I like the fact that you're hyperkinetic and you're all over the place, bouncing around like a pinball machine, but you've got to monster somebody or I'm downgrading you. And we have to see that within this defined period of time or you taper and you become an incredible senior statesman, possibly a coach if you don't want to be a farmer, and get there. I think that's true. That's fair. And I think you owe someone like that because he's given blood, sweat, and tears. I think for other positions, it's different. So I think there's a speed factor in some of the backline positions that is just measurable. I call them lekkerbacks, the mysteriously scrum-capped, you know, overly developed strong guys with unnecessary scrum-caps who can, you know, do repeat movements and don't seem to get tired. There's a possibility that a guy like Chesson Colby loses a step, and then suddenly that's not really a point of difference. So I think you do have to take each position, and age is very different for a wing than it is for, say, a lock. But I think you have to be unsentimental. Now, I think Rossi has always shown himself to be both. someone who trusts and loves and has brotherhood with some people, but also unsentimental enough to say, sorry, Andre, you're a player 34B and you're going to sit around for a while we figure this out. He's benched people that were icons, Dwayne Vermeulen in a knockout. So I think he's going to have to apply that. What I saw in his face when he walked in, sheepish, humbled, humiliated, almost that nervous giggle, I could sense that there's probably a knife in his back pocket. And he's not going to tolerate that for too long. So maybe when you put that all into some sort of package, it's an early warning sign. It's definitely, it's a shot over the bow for the, I can go, you know, 3 World Cups in a row. Not everyone can, not everyone will. Some will not even go 2.
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, initially, I think teams struggled to go back-to-backs because they always held on to the guys that were there in the beginning. I mean, we saw it with a great English team in 2007. Like, you go a little bit too far, you know, like those guys. We saw it in, well, even like, you know, okay, 2011 was not a good thing to bring up again because Bryce Lawrence dicked us. We all know that. But there's certain aspects of that. And it's always about you want the experience and the composure. We started the show saying, like, who's game managing? But now we also want, like, Cameron Hunnicorn was all over the place. Because we need that sort of exuberance. So I'm of the opinion that this tour of New Zealand is probably the most important tour, because most of we don't have tours. But this is so important now because the guys can really narrow in on this. And I really do think that in the greater scheme of things, yes, they're focused so hard on this thing. But it gets them away from local press. It gets them away from all the local admiration. Maybe the fanfare around the box has actually got a little bit too over the top. I think... to go play a game where a plane doesn't fly over the stadium for once, that might actually narrow it in a little bit. Go to a place where there isn't so many heavy media demands and everyone's blowing smoke up your ass. It's almost like this team needs a New Zealand tour now more than anything else.
There's been so much study and maybe speculation about the role of motivations in top-level sport. But whether or not we can compartmentalize it and tell you exactly the category that works, we know that it does matter. And one of the greatest fears and drivers that we can ever have is the fear of humiliation. It's the substance of most of our nightmares. You know, you arrive naked to do a speech you haven't prepared for. That. So as a team, as a group, and I'm including everyone, physios, SNC, nutritionists, everyone, players, coaches, they've been humiliated and now they fear that again. And on tour to the toughest place to play for us at Eden Park, that's palpable. I mean, you would absolutely worry about your pants being pulled down.
Yep.
And you would wonder about how bad it's going to be. Wasn't that long ago that the 57s happened?
Yep.
And so that's a powerful impulse. If I'm a coach, I like so many parts of this game at Ellis Park to show you so we're all serious together. And we're facing the abyss. We're at the precipice. They're going to laugh at us. They're going to make fun of us. They're going to ridicule us. We're going to be a laughingstock. That is super powerful for proud warriors. And that is more powerful sometimes for the older guys who don't want to go out like that. They want to go out on their shield one way or the other. They don't want to be embarrassed. And that's when sometimes also for the younger guys, it's really difficult to walk into Eden Park your first time. It's daunting. It's like Tom Hooper came to Loftus a few years ago. And he literally felt like he was worried he'd be murdered and he couldn't play. This time around, at Ellis Park, Tom Hooper was throwing bodies around. So I do think when you go to Eden Park, you have to time who you can drop into that. You know, Sasha is not overawed by any situation. I back him to go there. Someone else, like Hooker, who's throwing for the first time, you know, minute 79 to seal. I don't know if you do that. So then maybe you do get Bongi one more time because he's an old warrior and you trust him in those moments. But I do take your point. I think you're exactly right. That these tours can be a blessing and they can be a moment to say, no one believes us anymore. We've got to fight our way out. We're in this. We're trapped. We're in a trench. Everyone's dropping mustard gas on us. What are we going to do? Who can we shoot in the head right now? And sort of Zell's philosophy is about that you do that with size, your point of difference. You roll over folks. I don't think you can do that with the All Blacks as currently constituted. They have a really tough pack too. You're not going to get scrum penalties for free. So I do like the idea of finding new ways to attack in the 22, but I don't think you can go 7 meters, 7 meters, 7 meters on rucks and then say to Wilco Lowe, hey, you with the giant thighs, get from here to there at this height. I mean, it's just not feasible. So you do have to have some variety. I think within this squad, there is a team to beat New Zealand. I think for sure there's a 15 and a 23 in this that could even do back-to-back, but that would be amazing. It also would shut up everyone about Ellis Park. Ellis Park will become a footnote if we win in Eden Park and maybe take one of those two in Paris and Dublin. But if we don't, Ellis Park becomes the definitional story of 2025. And all the whisperers and jackals that want to say, you've reached your peak, you're tapering, they'll be alive and well.
Just going to let you pause in that moment there because there's the show cut down. I mean, but you're so right. This is why I'm so happy that we got to chat after this Ellis Park game because, like, the dust needs to settle on what's going on right now. You mentioned France and Ireland. I mean, right now, do you reckon, like, we always know with this team, like, they're being hailed for being innovative the whole time, always thinking ahead, always thinking out of the box. In fact, there is no box anymore. They're just out of it so much. But now, like, do you think the box are even focusing at all on France and Ireland right now?
It's difficult to know inside how far ahead they plan and if the various personalities even mix that way. You know, there's Felix Jones, Jerry Flannery. They get together and talk about, you know, what's gelling and how long that lead time is. Is there an overarching kind of understanding that this is what this season's about and this is what that? I think maybe they kind of make that up as they go along and they adjust.
Yeah, because it always sounds great in a press conference after the fact and if things are going well. It's like, well, you know, we had this pod here, we tried this and we're always playing towards this.
I think there's too much vicissitudes in sport. And you're always one blown out knee from a completely different plan. And there are players that shape your team in a certain way. If Ibn Etzebeth and Malcolm Marks are not there, you're suddenly a very different team. So I don't know if you can do that in any employment or workplace or business. Yes, you have workplace injuries, but you don't expect two every week.
Yeah.
And so when you're playing your key man and your promotions and your executive council, you don't have to go, oh, but you know, Alice might be knocked out next week. So I do think there's a bit of fluff there. And if you average, I think about two guys have a niggle per week and one guy returns over the course of this season, it's difficult to know who'll be in Paris. It's difficult to know who'll be playing in Dublin. But I do think each season has a story. And I think there was a season for experimentation with higher count. And this was supposed to be the tapering sort of season where we start to see what the incumbency is.
I mean, last season was what, 53 caps? So last year was the let's spread it out. But I mean, as you say, like this has to now taper. But the tapering itself is a mind-blowing thing there because, again, it goes back to the workload. The guys know that they are so stretched. I know Saru's got those mandatory breaks for teams, right? It's like you've been watching URC and suddenly this guy's not playing because he's on a mandatory break. So this kind of stuff happened. It's been built into the system. So to taper down now on these tours, I'm pretty excited about. But now if you would look at – I just want to finish off this whole thing about incumbency because, again, I'm glad you brought it up because I look at this and I think I really want this back because it's almost like it was a cool party trick to say we've got three guys per position. It's wonderful. It also stops them going and playing for teams like Wales or Ireland or England on ancestral visas or some shit. Also get that. That's the strategy. But now, is it about going and using this tour to actually implement like, okay, now we're going to go and work on incumbency. And now you guys know what it's – because you've all had a taste of what it's been to be a Bok. Like a Bowen Fenter coming in here. You now know what the standard is. If you want to get here, you got to keep raising on that. That's 19 Club of Kenya, same kind of thing. The guys go back to their respective clubs and franchises, always knowing that every single day I need to be a Bok, and this is what it means being a Bok. So to go back to the incumbency thing here, if you were to say like a match day 23 that you would have a lot of confidence to be durable, what does that kind of look like now?
Yeah, I think there is that. So I think, and here's why I think it's always been a little bit of a BS thing. If it were a knockout for the Rugby World Cup, I do think they do know who the incumbents are.
Well, if you look at our last World Cup, they played the exact same team in every single match in the playoffs.
Yeah.
One pointer.
It's just that they don't grade, they don't rate an opening match in the Rugby Championship against the Wallabies as highly as they will say publicly. Internally, they don't. That's clear. Or they wouldn't have done a Mani Lebok Fassi 10-15 decision-making. It just wouldn't have. It wouldn't make sense. So I think, you know, the tight forwards sort of, they pick themselves. Ox is definitely someone who has a multi-skilled game. He goes at the back. He can scrum. He cleans. He carries. Marks is clearly the first choice hooker now. The old game where he was sort of the bomb squad guy doesn't really work if Bongi's struggling with some of his core duties. Vukolo, pending holding place for Frans Malherbe, is definitely sort of the banker now at scrum. But he costs you a bit in defensive capabilities that Frans gives you. Not just because Frans is somehow more agile, but he just knows the system better. He knows where to be, and he's sort of a captain there. Eben was supposed to be, you know, paired with Lewitt. Lewitt at this point looks like a question mark. There was a point at 25 minutes where he's running around like a zombie and his hands sort of just floating and he just couldn't keep up. So there's a wonder there.
But would you say that that's down to game time or is it?
Could be. He's still a guy that, you know, carries so well. He's got incredibly soft hands. He hits his marks on the pod. And probably his cleaning has to be worked on a little bit and the ability to sustain that lactic acid and get down low. Japan has a sort of a gentleman's agreement in a way not to play too rough. Peter Steftatoy, one of the great players of history. And then you have the sort of number eight conundrum where we're pretending that there's not really a position called number eight that's manned by eighth men who play, you know, number eight. We know how to keep a ball at their feet to milk a scrum penalty. Like Sia doesn't know, hasn't done it that much at test level. The idea of someone being playing that middle. So if Sia's playing the side, you'd almost wonder like maybe put Peter Steph at 10 at eight then. You know, just someone who's a big enough body to stop that middle.
Or even like a Kobus Visser.
So we're waiting on Jasper Visser. Maybe, you know, little brother is gonna man that. And we have this aversion allergy to Evan Ruiz. That needs to be cured or something.
Him and Rusty need to go to Caprice one Sunday and just iron out whatever the problem is. Or maybe the problem started at Caprice.
Yeah, I think it's the dad, actually. So, so, and I think that Rusty does like to punish you a little bit and show you, you know, who's boss. And I think he sees in Evan a lot of himself. I think if there's one player that's the most like him in playing style, it'd be Cameron Honeycomb. But in...
I never thought of that.
Like
that's
in just
that's
his belligerence and his... you know, just an inability to sometimes read the room and play nice with others. I think you're always hardest on your children or the people that you're around that remind you of yourself because it irritates you. So
please bring this up at the next press conference. So,
there you go. Tossed out. So there's that. So if everyone's healthy, I think you see it. The question mark to me for 2027 is Sia, because maybe you do have to have a Fraser McWright. Maybe you do have to have an actual on-ball player if you're going to have so many wide rucks. Now, if we're going to make our rucks come to the middle again and we're going to have maybe more non-rucks or we're going to have more kicks over the top, a kick and a kick, so you actually regain a kick and then kick again, which actually works really well if you go to Coffin Corner, you don't have to have an on-ball fetcher because everyone's a fetcher, you know? Damien Delende, Malcolm Marks. But I think if you're going to play this way, then you need to look at who is the person who can play six? And you have to take really unsentimental, hard looks that are really gruesome and brutal.
Yeah.
Back line, I think, again, I think...
Sorry, before you get to the backs there, how much does it bother you that Sia, if he gets there, is only going to be a 60-minute player anyway? Because, yeah. In a tight game, when you bring your captain off with 20 to go...
He also said in press conference that he was demoralized almost by some of the reverses they had in the 22. And that's what tired him out. He wasn't tired sort of physically. It was more the emotional of not being able to convert and punch through or losing a line out. And that didn't strike me the same as the same Sia. And also I think at some point when you get everything you said you wanted in life, which has happened at least four times to me, you actually find out about yourself. You go, oh, wait, that wasn't really what I wanted. I wanted more. But sometimes you do get it, and then you have a hard time running into a wall again. You have a hard time finding that dark place. You don't want to wrestle around in the dark, in the mud, for one knife when you could be home, safe, So everyone reaches that point different ways.
That was the whole Buster Douglas in the silk pajamas thing, right?
That's it. So he might have found that place where it's not there for him. Whereas it looked like Australia was battling for pride to avoid, you know, incredible humiliation. Harry Wilson looked like he would just keep running until all of his hamstrings burst out. So I think that's something to factor in. Rice's always said it was about character and willingness to die. You lied, all that stuff. So where is it now? But I do think there are resources, and there are resources if you make that one decision, then other things flow from it. So if you keep trying to find a place for Sia because he wants to play that hour and have that ceremonial function, but if the real captain's someone else already, then let's just be honest about it now. Don't wait until. We also have this sort of weird cap gap where we have a lot of caps, sort of 60 to 100, and we have a lot of, you know, 0 to 25, and we have this sort of bubble of nothingness around 40.
Which was where most of that team was on the up and up when we won those things.
So on your question of, you have to actually decide, are the guys that are from about five, like one cap to about 20, right now, you've got to pick if it's Asenati or Vincent. You've got to actually say right now, is it Lewitt or is Archia actually the starting lock? Is he my lineup caller or is it Nortje? Which one is it? Because then that's sort of your off lock. Ibbins never liked calling lineouts. He's not going to be a lineout captain. And you have to have, you know, that mix. So I think the pack is still good enough. What I've just said is still good enough. You have one giant question mark at hooker, a backup hooker, and you've got another giant question mark on, do you want to have an on-ball, you know, ball slower, jackal pilfer guy, or do you not? And if you do, then I don't think C is your man to take you for two more years.
Yep. And now we head into the backs in the same analytical context.
Your midfield's rock solid, right? It's one of the great midfields in history.
Yep.
The age profiles are fine if they can just take care of their bodies. There's something very rock solid about that. You have natural understudies in Andre, who doesn't have as good ball security in my mind and also doesn't understand the defensive system. So it makes Jesse look bad on an island. But he's still there. Ethan Hooker is obviously a bright spark. I'm not sure about Kanan Moody as understudy. I kind of still think he should be a big wing.
I totally agree with you.
He could take cross kicks and, you know, stretch you out. I just don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if he's quick enough in the hips. And then I think on wings, you have this sort of assembly line of people that it looks like you can have. Like, you look at guys like Curly Aronsa, and even though it's not that many caps, you still trust him if he's physically okay. They looked a bit burned out. At fullback, it's a straight shootout. It's Willemse and Fassi probably battling for that succession role. And then I still think Pollard is your steerer, your pilot in a storm. And then you have the ability to do some horsey-coursey stuff for 23. If you go 6'2", if you go 5'3", you can say, I want Sasha to be my player at 23, or I want someone else. But I think that's some play. That's fine. At number 9, I think scrum offs, you increasingly looks like Grant Williams is the sort of the favored one. He seems to have a really nice kick nowadays. It floats, it hangs, it's got a 4-second time. He is a danger. Kubas is getting quite old, actually. Faf is none too young. So you're looking probably at Mornay as maybe that successor role. I'd let them bet in and let's see if Mornay can be at 25 caps, you know, going into 2027.
But do you see it as a combination choice, though? So you'd only pick Mornay if it's Andre, or you'd only pick Mornay if it's Sasha, or you only pick Grant if it's Sasha. I mean, do you see it more about the combinations because of what you said earlier around the fact that you need this sort of odd couple relationship here to really make something go? Because a 9-10, especially when it comes to World Cup time, that access is crucial.
I still think, and I'll always think this, that if I can cut the time from the ball, from the base, with a really strong bullet pass from 9 to whoever, a forward, a 10, a 12, that's one of the best things in rugby.
Yeah.
Like, all good things come from that. So I would be so nerdy as to time that and make sure I knew exactly, you know, if you're in practice and 40, 50 balls later, who's still got the zip, that chip technology that shows me the spiral turn, the easiest to catch. I love that for Andre. I want Andre to get the ball with as much time as possible. So if it's Mornay, it's Mornay. Williams obviously quicker on the feet. So maybe that's more of a late game, you know, situation. So that's me. I was just telling you what I think this current brain trust is doing is they like Grant's ability to use the space that the new emphasis in the laws has given nines and do the DuPont, but with quick, you know, quicker feet. Use that sort of I'm untouchable, you know, and I think they're also looking at what the game, where the game's going, and wondering about where they're going, right? I still maybe am more of a purist about nines. If you can finish your pass where you're still crouched, like Cam Røygaard, I just feel like it's such a weapon because the ball gets there 0.03, 0.04 quicker, and then everyone is better. Everyone's better.
Everyone. It's a massive domino effect. If everyone could do their jobs better and easier.
Yeah.
Harry, look, I didn't start this podcast feeling like it was a panic station, and I definitely finish it not feeling like it is a panic station either. I think the very good point that you make there was that within the squad, we've got the 15-23 to go to New Zealand and get it done. And I think as a natural result after that, when managed, I still think we got it to go do the three-peats in 2027. But there's just, yeah, it's just what makes being a rugby fan so damn fun. Like, we can go through permutations forever and ever. I just desperately wanted you to go to 1-15. Because, I mean, I agree with you on so many of those points there. There's always going to be a plan B. There's always going to be things that aren't going to go according to plan. And I think this team has given us the impression that they are the best at that. And for the first time, we didn't see it on the weekend. So I think that's when the panic station comes into it. But they've got a hell of an opportunity to kind of get back in our good book, so to speak, although that's not their primary goal. They're professionals. They've got jobs here. We're just the drunk guys on the side getting very animated about this. But yeah, I don't see it as a massive panic. I think it's you're constantly learning until you've got the job done. And that job done is 2027. Yeah, I mean, I think we have to just wrap it up there because I think we're fine. I really do. But it's just the best thing that we've got another tough game against the Aussies coming up. And then we go to New Zealand to really show what our minerals are.
Yeah, there's nothing that will ever make me fall out of love with rugby, with the box, with South Africa, with the tremendous culture we have of being embattled, always sort of, it's always a curveball. There's nothing will ever come normal, easy. I cannot imagine any plan that involves South Africa rugby and us that will go to plan. I just don't think it exists. And we're forever in this sort of incredible embrace of the pain, the hope, the violence, the memories. It's what makes rugby the most brilliant of all sports. You know, it mimics combat. It mimics military campaigns. And yet it's also just moments of insanity. You know, blitzes from nowhere. And I think there's plenty here. If we get the right mix of our various strengths and groups and cultures and innate abilities, I still think we've got this because no one else can really get there. They cannot be as quick. They cannot be as strong. They cannot be as tough. They cannot be sort of kind of cool, stupid at times. They don't have the same fire. It doesn't burn as bright. It's a facsimile. It's plastic. But we also have the ability to burn each other and sort of get way out ahead of ourselves. And this maybe is the best thing, but right now it feels like shit. And I remember it was one of the first times I have felt since 2011 when I remember waking up in Wellington and wondering, was that a dream? And I heard a saxophone playing, a drunk Aussie, Waltzing Matilda. And I thought, no, it is. In this overpriced hotel, this great plan that my son and I had to go to the finals is done. And so, yeah, Australians like to ruin our dreams. This one's not like that, right? But I remember waking up, I woke up this week and just thought, that's a really stupid loss to take.
Yeah.
Like it was unnecessary in the extreme. A few changes here and there, a Snyman on the bench, a couple of locks that can clean, Kubas Visa, and just someone on the field who comes in, probably a Pollard, and just is a sport. I'm sorry, too many DJs. I'm the cleanup crew. We're going to put everything away. It's going to be fine.
I love that. I love how you just encapsulated all of that because it's so true. All fixable. Right, so if you're watching the show, obviously this week, early in the week, this weekend is going to be the Aussies in Australia. Harry, are you going down for that? You're going to be amongst it.
Oh, yeah. I cannot wait to go home. And to be, you know, on, around, coast, mountain, stadium. I think the whole vibe around it's brilliant. And I think it's shaping as such a strange match in some ways, because both teams will be properly ready, settle some scores, and I'm hoping for the best.
So if you want to get more of Harry on X, X is your most prolific platform, right?
Yes.
It is, interestingly, at Harry Baldy Jones. Harry with an I, Baldy with an I, Jones. And, of course, the Lekker Rugby Pod every week.
Yes, we have a Praetorian, MV of Elman, stoic, taciturn, doesn't like DJs at all, by the way. And then we have me, a rogue, who couldn't stay home, wandered the world and tried to fix scandals unsuccessfully, mostly my own. And so we play off that, you know, as you could imagine, the Cape Town boy gone wrong and the Praetorian boy who never left the shadow of Afis. And you know, we tried to bring that sort of contrast to it. And also think that's a brilliant way to see South African rugby.
It really is, because it is all of those things you described. This scandal, this madness, this rogueness, it's all these good things. But yeah, we all love the box. We always are going to love the box. And I tell you what, a setback every now and again isn't obviously the worst thing, as long as they're not done in the same way and repetitively. So next week, we are going very hard into the LIV Golf. We've got Chris Bentley from LIV Golf, who's going to be here on the couch. And we've got OG Malefi, he is returning as well. LIV Golf in March, obviously, is a really big thing. If you have noticed, Shaz sort of went missing halfway through the show. Monty Lubbock actually arrived at the studio and hauled him out for 6 months of trash talk. So we'll see if how Shaz is doing after the show. But thanks so much for joining us this week. Bok rugby season, it's still going to be the biggest season. We've been saying it the whole year so far. The All Blacks are the next big thing after the home games. And of course, there is still Ireland and France to look forward to at the end of the year. I am all spoken out. Harry, thanks for the insights. It's been great to actually physically see you in the flesh. I genuinely do love your podcast. I listen to it. It makes me feel smart. And yeah, I mean, obviously, no point in saying you have the good work. It's just really great seeing you more involved now in the sort of press accreditations, getting into places. And please ask Rusty about the relationship with Ifan Rus, and if it is something very close to home like that.
Offer my mediation services.
Go for it.
Yeah, no, cheers, Ben. Really good to be here and great to see your setup, a proper studio for once.
Yeah, we're trying. We're going to get out on the road a little bit more as well, as we have done this last week. So follow us on the TRN, on X, TRN on the bounce, and of course, just on _the bounce on Instagram. We'll catch you back next week.